Welcome to the Mike and Doug Show. I'm Doug. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Doug.
This is a production of Aim for Truth and Americans for Innovation, as usual. And today we're going to discuss the Marshall Plan, or as I like to call it, corporate oligarchic takeover of other countries after a war. It's just so transparent, and it's just it repeats so many times in history. But today you're going to tell us, because of amazing research you've done, because a lot of people may say these things, but if they don't come up with the real tangible evidence and the research that shows, you know, things that are proof beyond a shadow of a doubt of interlocking connectedness between all these different corporations that get rich off of war, then it's just, it's like somebody saying, oh, the military industrial complex, of course, as we all know. Well, no, people don't know, and they need to have it proven to them. So today, George Marshall is under the microscope of Michael McKibben. What do you have to tell us about the Marshall Plan?
Well, first of all, this bumps up against the time when we showed up on the Earth, and many of the people involved with the Marshall Plan were politicians and corporate leaders while both of us were growing up. So we're now edging into contemporary domain of history, and what we're seeing now is more of the same, that what we were told about these people and what they were doing in our government is not what they were doing, and we were totally deceived. And it's just, sometimes when we look at this information, it's easy to get incensed by the level of the lies and deceptions that were told us about the end of World War II and the Marshall Plan and the alleged attempt to rebuild Europe. And now we can see what was really going on. And if we move this to the current time, what we're seeing is a list of corporations and organizations that are the very ones to this day that are trying to take down President Trump and to convert America into another region of the UN. That's what we see out of this.
And we see it on both sides. You've been tracking down gold and bankers, but also the Committee of 300, all these Pilgrim Society members, Council on Foreign Relations members. But now it's tracked back to after World War II, when basically a syndicate of corporations went to Europe under the auspices of providing aid after, of course, we blew up Europe, and now we're going to go and rebuild it. But basically, they're all contracts only with Americans and Canadians and the Brits. So really what it was a further attack upon the people we just conquered with bombs and bullets, and now they're going to be conquered economically. And what you see is a complete scam from the time of World War I, when Charles Dawes and the Dawes Plan did the same exact thing. And people who were what we called robber barons of those days, Rockefeller, Carnegie, of course, Rothschild bankers, who, you know, Rothschild always tries to hide behind other names, other banker names, of course.
Yes, he does.
But you see those same exact oligarchs becoming basically government monopolies on both sides of the war, and in some cases, literally like good old Bush's bank, the Union Bank, and Harriman Brown Brothers, and others were basically giving aid to the enemy. So they were making money on both sides of the war. And this is the part that is really disturbing to me. We go, we're basically propagandized into World War I and II by the Brits. And then what do? We rebuild Britain after both wars and give so much money to these corporate oligarchs, as I called them, that they now basically rule America. They are the Fortune 500 companies and the people who have the true principal power and control of those elements that are always part of what they call the war board. And if you're on the war board, like an Edwin Pauly, who became the, in World War II, the petroleum controller, he was like Rockefeller in World War I. And what happened to him? He became so wealthy that he had to literally move out of this country and move to Canada to hide his wealth. And then he became knighted by the Queen for all that he did for the Brits. So once again, it's the Brits, it's the bankers, and it is the a group of people that are part of the War Board who create these policies that under the auspices of it's war, it's okay. We have to throw away all the rules during this time. And then you get to see the corruption, and that's what you've brought forth, is just the amazing amount of corruption. And what I focus on, of course, is the Bank for International Settlements, because that's the central bank control of the gold. And it, even before World War II was over, they went to a gold standard through the Bretton Woods agreements, which created the International Monetary Fund. Why? Because Germany had looted all the gold of Europe, and Japan had looted all the gold of the East. And they knew that it was sitting there as war booty. And by golly, if they didn't create organization after organization to go out and steal that war booty and then try to bring it through these syndicates, through the syndicate that has these cabal of corporate oligarchs on it, they try to bring this gold into the marketplace, demonstrating that capitalism and the free market does not exist, especially when you're controlled by the people on the War Board.
Well, you know, Douglas, that's a good framing for what we have discovered. And I want to tell you a little story, because about 10 years ago, I was doing a lot of work raising funds to build our software program. And I made a trip up to a particular capital city in the Midwest. I won't say which one, but was introduced through a professor to a man who was the largest donor, was the largest donor to the Democratic Party in this state. And we were talking, and he represented several venture capital funds. And during the course of the conversation, he said something that I had no context for. He said, "Nothing happens in tech in the United States without the approval of the Acela Mafia." And I had never heard that term, and neither had any of the other people that were with me. And so we asked him what that meant. And he said, "Well, have you ever been on the East Coast and rode the bullet train? It's called the Acela train, and it goes from Washington, D.C. up to Boston with stops in Wilmington, Philadelphia, New Haven, and New York." And he said that essentially the corporations, by and large, the banks and certain other organizations, including Princeton, Yale, Harvard, and Columbia, were a part of this cabal that he said secretly drove all decision-making in tech financing in the United States. And I had no context for that, and he didn't give me any details. And I did ask him, "Are you a part of this mafia?" And he said, "No, I was never invited to join." And I just stuck that in the back of my head and have wondered what it meant all these days, all these years. And then we stumbled on the name of Dean Rusk, who was somebody that I remember because he was Secretary of State under both Johnson and Kennedy. And during the 50s, Dean Rusk was the president of the Rockefeller Foundation. And so we started digging more into Dean Rusk's background, and we discover that he is what you would have to describe as a flaming warmonger. There was never a war he did not like. He was the Secretary of State during the Vietnam War. He was a chief advocate of the Korean War, and pretty much out of college, only ever worked for the State Department. So he was clearly a groomed individual. And right up through the Johnson administration, he was pushing wars. And so as we now know, we see a one-to-one correlation between the bankers that we're talking about and their desire for war, and as you said, to be able to fund both sides. So we looked at Rusk, we looked at the other secretaries of state, because as we have talked about before, way back in 1912, a very intrepid suffragette by the name of Lillian Troy actually identified that one of the 24 points of the control that the Pilgrim Society was looking to exert over America was they had to have control of the Secretary of State's position, in addition to the Supreme Court justices. And so as we have looked at the success of Secretaries of State since the founding of the Pilgrim Society in 1902, we have not found one Secretary of State that wasn't a Pilgrim. And so we assumed that Rusk had to be a Pilgrim, so we dug deeper. And then that marched us back to the end of World War II. And I had never spent a lot of time looking at it. I knew from just being around that the Marshall Plan was there to help the Europeans. That's what I was told. So we started looking into, as you know, our researchers are not satisfied with just that kind of anecdotal information. We started digging and we discovered buried very deeply a 1,200-page congressional report that was, I have it here in front of me, not all 1,200 pages, but I have the testimony of Dean Acheson, who had just resigned as the chairman of the, what was his position? He was either the War Board or he was Secretary of State. I don't remember which. Anyways, the Foreign Policy for a Post-War Recovery Program. And he was appearing before Congress and they were looking at a proposal that has come to be called the Marshall Plan. But at that time, it was only a month old, this idea. And Acheson was testifying and asking Congress for money. And cut a long story short, he asked for $8.6 billion. In the end, they ended up getting $15 billion, which in today's money is about $200 billion. So they were asking for a significant amount of money. And he came before the committee, and starting on page 687 of this report, it's his detailed testimony. And one of the first things he did was he informed Congress that a month before that, the Secretary of War Stimson had just written an article for the Foreign Affairs magazine, which is a Council on Foreign Relations publication. And Acheson was pitching this idea that as a result of this 11-page article that Stimson wrote, that there was a groundswell of energy in the country among all industry segments to help Europe rebuild. And they spontaneously, according to their testimony, formed a committee about 300 people that all had this great desire to rebuild Europe. And, I'm trying to not be sarcastic, but that was the opening pitch, by the way. And then he proceeded to include a pamphlet into the Congressional Record, which described the members of this committee, only 4 weeks old, by the way, and it was a who's who list among educators, bankers, media people, industry, certain industries, labor leaders, and this list was a very interesting list because in the executive committee, it included people like Robert P. Patterson, who was the former Secretary of War. It included Dean Acheson, who was Secretary of State. It included Winthrop W. Aldrich, who was a Rockefeller. The Aldrich name is the Nelson A. Rockefeller's middle initial. And other people like Alger Hiss, who was an alleged Soviet spy, and other people. So that list was kind of interesting. So we actually took that list of 300 people and have broken it down and created a spreadsheet out of it and to identify who was on this list and what did they represent in terms of the cross-section of America. Because Acheson pitched the idea that this was a broad cross-section of America. But as we can see now, this list was only peopled with very leftist individuals, corporations, churches, nonprofits, service organizations, and many labor leaders. That was the first telltale sign there's something wrong with this list. Secondly, there's one thing, there's a principle when you testify to Congress, and the principle is that when you put information before Congress, you have to tell the truth, and you have to not be deceptive and hide things that people should know. And there's a test called materiality. In other words, you should disclose something to the public if the information you would not otherwise disclose is material to the public understanding what it is you're saying. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Okay. So the question is, did these people properly disclose their relationships with each other on this list of 300? By the way, Congress never actually created this list. It was created by Stimson, by Acheson, and it was pushed forward in this brochure as the committee that would be managing the Marshall Plan. So that's a very interesting trick. Just push it out there, say, hey, we got this great list. They all came to me magically within 4 weeks, and we put this list together. And then each one is described with their current position at the time and the company and where they're from, what state and what city. And we broke that all down, and what we discovered, not unsurprisingly, is it was by far and away the largest group of people that were involved with this organization were bankers, and then second media people, educators, and it went on down the line, but predominantly bankers and predominantly New York, Washington, and Boston. And despite the fact that Acheson said that his list was a cross section of America, it wasn't at all. And in fact, as we started breaking down the memberships here, we discovered that they omit a very material piece of information, that the entire executive committee with perhaps there's 19 on the executive committee, and all but one were members of the Pilgrim Society. And of the 300, about 119 were members of the Pilgrim Society. And then it got even more interesting because at the same time, a group of a list of Council on Foreign Relations members came into our hands. And we looked at that list compared to this list. And we discovered that about an equal number, about 119 members of this list were members of the Council on Foreign Relations. Now, why is this important? You want me to stop?
No, I explained why these 300 people are all in bed with interlocking directorships.
Okay. Yeah, please. We had, as we have been unpacking the congressional record since the turn of the last century, we discovered that, in fact, there were numerous congressmen and senators that were on a trail to track these people down and were carrying on major hearings. And you use the word that they used, and that is that we're discovering and analyzing the interlocking relationships of all these corporations and actually identifying their associations with the Pilgrim Society. And the interlocks were on the record, but they were buried, and they were hard to find. They were in this particular interlock situation with the Marshall Fund was in a 1,200-page document, and unless you knew what you were looking for, you weren't going to find this. And so we then discovered that Acheson put this group of people forward, and across the board failed to disclose to the American public that this was controlled by the Pilgrim Society and its offspring, which was the Council on Foreign Relations. And neither one of those organizations was ever mentioned in this testimony, which went on for a whole day. And in the testimony, it is replete with all the now typical Tavistock Institute keywords to scare Americans into giving them this money that they were asking for fear that Europe might slide back into oppression, or that the bad pinko commies in Russia would move forward if they didn't step up and help Europe rebuild. I mean, it was every scare tactic you can think of was used in this document. So what we have here, Douglas, I think, and I'm going to stop and let you comment, I think we have a smoking gun here for current history, because what we see here is a group of companies that are still in play right now, and organizations, and to a company and to a man, either these people or their relatives or their successive companies are front and center in this attack on our president and our republic to this day.
Beyond a shadow of a doubt. And the gold that was demanded of Germany for reparations with Charles Dawes, the Dawes Plan, which was then managed through the Bank for International Settlements, that during the time between the wars, the Bank for International Settlement was how they laundered the gold and how they adjusted the reparations. And this became a gigantic manipulative institution for literally controlling world markets. By the time it got to World War II, it was so institutionalized, and they knew that Germany had moved half of its gold to Basel, Switzerland, to the Bank for International Settlements and other Swiss banks, as well as American banks, good old Prescott Bush's bank, Union Bank, which was prosecuted for aiding the Nazis during the war. This type of gold that was, Hitler stole from Czechoslovakia, was moved to Basel, Switzerland, and was held there, 23 tons of gold. Well, they did that to every single country that the Nazis came to. And then that gold was stolen. And it was known where it was being shipped. That gold has still not been brought into the market. Now, that's what some call the Black Eagle gold. That is the Nazi gold, you could call it.
It's called the M-Fund.
It's called so many different names. I was looking up some of them this morning, the Black Eagle Fund, the Nazi the gold, the blah, 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 blah. But anyway, the point is everybody knew that they took the gold from the Jews, melted it down, and put it into German gold bullion bars stamped with their standard eagle on it. And this gold still has not come into the market, and it has not been found.
Before you get off that subject, I want to point out a couple of things related to this testimony. There are two people identified in this testimony as members of this committee. One is William J. Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, the head of OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which is the precursor to the CIA. And another gentleman by the name of Alan Dulles. Donovan set up his office in Bern, Switzerland. And Bern is the headquarters right now for the Bank of International Settlements. And Switzerland's not a big country. So you mentioned Basel, but also we need to add Bern into that list as well. And what we have now done is found primary documents proving everything you're saying is absolutely true, and that it was known at the time that Donovan and Dulles were managing the transfers of this gold. And there was a lot of discussion about it at the time. But the interesting thing they did is it's like a shell game. They took this gold from Portugal, that gold from France, and they had all these names for the gold and the sources for the gold. And so there was an actual ledger created by the Department of State in 1998, where we see this information. There are about four different numbers that where they tried to get a handle on how much gold you were talking about, Douglas. And it went anywhere from maybe $25 million worth of gold all the way up to almost $1 billion dollars worth of gold at the time, which I think is about 11 or 12 times now today. And what we saw there was a very clever manipulation of the information to the point where nobody knew which end was up. And what they all concluded is that most of this gold was unaccounted for, like you say. And that's in the official government records at the Government Archives Office.
And the German Nazi gold is one half of the story. The other half is the Japanese Yamashita gold. As the Japanese conquered nations in the East, they stole all their gold, including China, and they put it into caves in the Philippines. Well, while Bill Donovan and the OSS worked with General Lansdale, who was in the Philippines, and basically this, you brought out documents. I've been studying this for decades. You literally brought out documents where they say, yeah, yeah, we know that General Lansdale had all this mysterious gold booty and that we're not going to talk about what happened to it. It's like, right. Whoa, they literally in public documents, government documents, all state that the gold is still missing. Well, we know where the gold is, and we know this routine, this type of economic predatory attack against gold is all because of the Bretton Woods agreements that created the International Monetary Fund, which in 1944, before the war was even over, they said, oh, no, all currency has to be in gold. That's because they knew that they were going to win. They're about to win, and they knew they were going to get all this booty. Today, in the news, I'm reading how Russia just recently gave back fantastic amounts of gold and art and paintings and amazing treasures to Germany because Germany has been demanding it back since the end of World War II. And finally, Russia is going to give some little pieces of it back. So we know where the gold is. It's in Zurich right now. It's in the, what's called the Zurich Bullion vault at the, literally at the Zurich airport. And those can be numbered bullion accounts. There can no longer be hidden Swiss numbered accounts because the U.S. Government went after them and prosecuted a lot of these Swiss numbered accounts. So now they can have Swiss gold bullion accounts. Why? Because people like Charles Dawes, people like George Marshall, people like George H.W. Bush, who I'm going to tell you in a little bit about Project Hammer and how they did the same thing to Russia twice, that they literally stole their gold twice, and they stole it in the same exact ways, economic manipulation of their currency to the point of collapse, buy up the currency, and then drain the central bank of the gold that's backing the currency, and or steal it. The second time they did it in Russia, they literally convinced the Russians to move their gold to Chechnya, and then it was all stolen. And that's just, it's absurd, but and people think that this is the craziest of conspiracies, but it is not a conspiracy at all. There have been lawsuits after lawsuits with Imelda Marcos and others in the Philippines saying the Americans stole our gold. And she says all of her gold, her husband's gold, came from the Yamashita gold. Well, the Yamashita gold has yet to surface, so where is it? We don't know how much it is, as you just stated. We don't know. Even speculation is wild. But we can for sure say there was at least, well, I'm not even going to say it because people won't believe it. But let's just say there is as much gold missing as there is accounted for gold in the whole world and all the central banks being held by nations as their personal treasury. So, and then what do they say? Oh, that gold is in the hands of people in jewelry, especially in China. No, they collected up all the gold in China. They collected up all the gold before the war, before both wars and after both wars. And they were after the gold. So why gold? We're no longer on a gold standard. We will be again, folks. That's a guarantee. And why is that? Because we've seen the IMF try to pull Russia and China in to having higher gold reserves to back their currency so that they could do a current. Again, this is a currency manipulation. The Marshall Plan, one of the major considerations was to break down the barriers between all countries so that you could have basically complete open trade, open currency exchange, and open ideas, basically stolen patents, that could then be shared with this syndicate of companies, these corporations that went in after World War One and after World War Two, specifically after World War Two. They're still there today. And the manipulation of this group, the Marshall Plan, it later became, the Marshall Trust Act, and then it became, it's now the USAID. $76 billion the Secretary of State gives away. Remember, the Secretary of State, as we've described, Charles Dawes and many others, who Secretary of State, they become the Vice President, and then they get control of foreign policy, just like Reagan gave over to George H.W. Bush complete control of foreign policy. That's why George H.W. Bush created the Hammer Project to steal the gold from Russia and to collapse their economy, which worked. That's why Obama put Biden in charge of Ukraine and Russia, where he went and, of course, enriched himself through nepotism, graft, and every type of other nasty name you can think of. But it's the emoluments that are here. Hillary Clinton did it with Uranium One. Before that, she did it openly with trade and manufacturing in China and later in Russia. So what we're dealing with here is standard operating procedure. This is institutionalized. And the warmongers are being led by the mafia don, Henry Kissinger, and the Council on Foreign Relations, that says to be a superior nation, you can only have one, and everyone below you must be in conflict. In other words, Henry Kissinger said war must continue on both sides, and we, as the superior nation of all nations, must foment that war. And then what did he do? He took, because we weren't on a gold standard, he put us onto a petrodollar standard. Why? Because this is how you control war. Look at how war is fought over gold in the past. It's fought over oil now. Most of the major current and wars in the last 50 years center around oil pipelines, oil, petroleum. And we get to see that it is still to this day a monopoly. The Seven Sisters control the oil of the world. What's the Seven Sisters? The antitrust results of breaking up Standard Oil. Rockefeller. How did Rockefeller become rich? World War One, he was given control of all kerosene, petroleum, and oil. That's how he became rich.
I need to point out that Rockefeller was also the owner of Chase Bank, Chase National Bank, which then merged later with J.P. Morgan. So we're talking about the same robber barons from the turn of the last century.
Absolutely. And right now, J.P. Morgan Chase has bought up all the silver coinage, because silver coinage printed by the U.S. Mint can be turned into currency with simply an act of Congress. And they can set the value of it with an act of Congress. Therefore, we already know that they were charged, the two biggest banks in America, charged with silver manipulation, and that they hold the largest store of silver minted coins anywhere. And that is obviously going to be what will be part of the basket of assets, which will be the new currency assets backing up our fiat currency here in America. So we're not going down, folks. The British are the ones who set all of this up. They're the ones who propagandize it. And they are the Anglo-American Alliance. Americans who are part of the Anglo-American Alliance aren't Americans.
They're traitors. We call it what it is. It's the Pilgrim Society.
Exactly. They are.
I don't know why there's such a hesitancy to name that name. It's almost like the name that cannot be named, like Voldemort.
No one will say it. And why? Because they're loyalists. We never won the American Revolution. The loyalists have remained. And right now, they're institutionalized as a senior executive service members, which outrank all of the civil servants in the federal government, and they are basically the resistance, and they're generally, most of them, Obama appointees, 8,500 of the 10,000, and they are the resistance, and they are Democrats. They are demon rats, and those are the idiots that believe the propaganda that the people we're describing have fed them as...
Yes.
As the it's actually garbage, but because they put a lot of sugar in it, these idiots, these liberals, these progressives consider all this conspiracy theory, and they think that's the past and history. It has nothing to do with the present.
Since you're talking about propaganda, we got onto this subject by looking at the Rockefeller Foundation, and we happened upon the financial report of the Rockefeller Foundation in 1946. And in there is an actual report, which we've been looking for about 3 years now, that describes their massive donation to the Tavistock, at that time, Tavistock Clinic. After they received this Rockefeller Foundation, they changed the name to the Tavistock Institute. And this is the organization that they empowered to develop all of these very sophisticated mind control and propaganda techniques that were used in Madison Avenue, on Fleet Street, and in all of this surveillance propaganda that we call now fake news. So you're exactly right. The same people had their bases covered. And if I could, I didn't want to interrupt you, Douglas, but if I could get back to that list for a minute, what we're going to post that list, and we're going to post the spreadsheet so people can manipulate it and do their own studies on it. But one of the things you'll notice is that there are a massive number of manufacturing companies and communication companies. I mean, we're talking IBM, we're talking NCR, IBM, NCR, JP Morgan, Rockefeller, Chase Bank, all the usual suspects that are funding the far left today and are in league with George Soros. Okay, so here's my question. Acheson and this crowd of corruptocrats was adamant to get $8.6 billion. And there were questions among the congressman. Well, do you need that much? Can you do it with five? And blah, blah, blah. And he basically was insistent on $8.6 billion. So what did they need that cash for, since they had all the gold in the world?
But they couldn't admit that they had all the gold in the world. The gold reserves in Britain had gone to zero. And Britain needed money from us. They got 26% of all the money given over all the 4 or 5 years of the Marshall Plan. And they still get huge amounts of money from us with USAID. You know, a rich country like Britain, we're giving them aid. Yes, we still do. And why did they need that money? Because when that money was given to them, America was bankrupt. So the money that was given, though it was backed by gold, it was fake money. It was debt to the
U.S. It was taxpayer dollars.
Yes. It's debt that we're still paying. And we're still paying the interest on that debt. And that's the way that it works. The central banks, it's all about the central banks. Okay? And so the British central bank completely was bankrupt. They did not think that World War II was going to do that to them, because they thought they had it all manipulated through the bankers ahead of time. But Winston Churchill decided to take it seriously and really go to war, instead of making it simply a banking war where it's just a depopulation control mechanism and a way to get patents, destroy German businesses, and make sure that Germany is no longer a world power. Well, it didn't work, did it?
Yeah, I wanted to bring up this patent issue, because in context, if you'll recall, in 1942, Roosevelt confiscated over 50,000 Axis patents, which would have been the patents that were given to American companies. I'll bet anything, predominantly the companies on this list. So what did they do in 45, 46? They jumped on this Marshall Plan. They had the patents of all those people in Germany and in England and in other places in Europe. They then formed corporations in Europe, got that money to fund those corporations and borrow money from these banks, from this gold. And then they exploited the very patents that they had just stolen from the people in Europe.
Yes, you're so right. The intellectual property theft from the patents, both in World War I and World War II, and continuously to this day, because the Brits steal all of our patents before we even look at them. They are the screening process to see if they get them first. So yes, as we know, and as you have brought out so often, this patent theft, when you're talking intellectual property, you're talking something worth more than gold. You're talking about the future. You're talking about also the control mechanisms that they use for propaganda, because all the wireless, all the technological inventions, all of the medical and pharmaceutical inventions, which we have shown have been used for war and have been weaponized, this is what they're about. We should not have the Department of War leading what it is that we're doing with our international policy. That is insanity. Plus, anyone who is ever Secretary of State has to be completely separated from any ability for self-aggrandizement. This is so historically evident, and it gets repeated so often that it's just disturbing. And all we need to do is pay attention, wake up, realize that the Brits do not have our best interests at heart, and that as we look back on World War I, World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, all of them, look at what happened in Syria. That was British intelligence that wanted us to go to war, though they weren't going to go to war. So what did Trump do the second time? Yeah, your stupid British and French intelligence. Well, guess what? I'm ignoring it. If you say that's going on there in Syria, you need to drop the bombs. Guess what they did? Next to nothing. So when we have alliances with Britain and France, immediately suspect the Anglo-American alliance that we are describing here, which is literally, it's a white supremacist desire for hegemony, world control through all these different methodologies, which they have become so good at that this is standard operating procedure. Now they've turned it into a pharmacy war, a vaccine war, but it's the same exact war. It's the same exact people. It's the same, for instance, they put one person in charge of the war board, and it may not be the Secretary of War. It may not be the Secretary of State. They put one person in many cases in charge of one section of it where they become, you know, billionaires. Right now, the pharmaceutical war against us and the vaccine war, all done by one person. The laws were created, the pandemic laws were created, but it comes down to an assistant director of the Health and Human Services agency who determines whether or not there is a pandemic and what we're going to do about it. One person. Has that person's name even come into the public? No. I'm not even going to bring it into the public. It's someone you don't know. One person that you don't know just controlled the whole world through a conspiracy that's been going on for 100 years, and all they did was flip the switch, because the pandemic laws were in place, the control of the National Institute of Health, the control of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and the World Health Organization, again, a United Nations, British, horrible group of people who want hegemony. Let's remember, United Nations comes out, and what are they saying? We want control of everything. Everything. There's nothing they don't want control of. Well, what is that? That's the plan of Cecil Rhodes. That's the plan of Alfred Milner. That's the plan of Jeffrey Paddock and Lord Malik Brown.
You know, that's, by the way, the
Privy Council's intent.
That's very evident in this list of people here that he's pitching the UN. He's identifying the fact that America has to give up its sovereignty to the UN in order to move forward and have peace.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, that anyone could even say that. America has to give up sovereignty. A country based upon the freedom and sovereignty of basically the individual who has joined together for the unalienable rights that cannot be taken from us, which are taken from us through the pandemic. They're taken from us. All our civil rights, our Constitution has been flushed down the toilet. Why? Because of laws passed by the same exact people on Capitol Hill that are enriching themselves from the very schemes that we're describing. And this is no exaggeration. Take Biden and what his enrichment from Ukraine with his son, his enrichment from China when he was the vice president in charge of foreign policy. How about Hillary Clinton? $86 billion she gave away as Secretary of State. But you know what was given back to her? More money than anyone can count, more money than anyone knows, because she was paid for those deals, just like Uranium One, $145 million in three checks from three board members, and $200 million from the Justra Clinton Sustainability Fund, $200 million paid to Hillary for the Uranium One deal. And she says she didn't know anything about it. She had appointed someone else in charge of CFIUS while she was the Secretary of State. She said she didn't even know of those deals. That's the kind of lying that we get that just institutionalizes this stuff.
There are two governments. There's this government, and then there is we the people who believe that we have a constitution and a bill of rights and are trying to live by it. But this group knows that they actually make the rules, they fund the rules, and anybody that they can't buy off, they'll threaten. And so this group has been very successful at getting to where they are, but it's taken them 120 years. Now, let's get back to this Marshall Plan document, because what I propose is this is new evidence. This is evidence of a fraud. This is evidence of a massive fraud that has just been discovered. How many years later? This was in 1946. It's just been discovered. We've just discovered that none of these people identified their membership in the Pilgrim Society or the Council on Foreign Relations. And we're talking about all these banks, all these collegiate institutions, some of these church organizations, labor unions, many manufacturing outfits, including many brand names today. We see that they participated in this fraud. Therefore, as a matter of definition, when assets are acquired based on fraud, that's the fruit of a poisonous tree. So the question on the table is this not evidence that the administration and the president can use to start reining in these companies? And one of the first ones that's really clear that's got to happen is this theft of the Japanese and German gold has to be returned. That's for starters.
That's why they can't bring it into the market, because then they'd get sued if anyone saw it come from an illegal source. And all the gold is really watched very closely, even though China came up with, 7,000 tons of counterfeit gold the other day from the Shanghai gold market. It was discovered. And so they do keep track of the gold. And so it's very hard to bring this stuff out. So they use it as assets.
When you say they keep track of it, what I saw on that report in 1997 was this guy reported there were four numbers. So this is typical of the bureaucracy. When they want to really hide what they're really doing, they create confusion. There were four numbers put forward, anywhere between maybe 100, 200 million up to a billion. And it was inconclusive how much there was. And then he kept caveating all of his numbers with, well, that's the best reporting we have right now. So that's a telltale sign that nobody knows the real number. This guy put this out there to satisfy his request from the president to go into this background, and they just spun it out until people stopped talking about it again. Typical bureaucrats.
I have a question, Mike. So what you're saying is that you have just discovered that JP Morgan, a lot of other companies, but let's just say JP Morgan was involved in treachery against the United States. Is that correct?
Yes, Chase and JP Morgan. Okay. Chase was Rockefeller at the time.
And because of this treachery, which we have just now discovered, so the clock is ticking, and we expect that the authorities in Washington will do something. Yeah, right. But it seems to me that this treachery is so severe that the United States citizenry should be able to go and seize all the assets of JP Morgan Chase today, with an eye on the precious metals that they have been hoarding by suppressing the price of silver and gold all these years so that they could get their hands on it. The American people couldn't, but it was all based on treachery.
Certainly treachery. I'm no gold or silver expert, but what I can see here is fraud. And I can see that whatever numbers were reported officially were all fungible anyway. And so the authorities don't even know how much it really is. But what we can see here is that the perpetrators of the theft, the use of the gold stolen from Germany, stolen from Japan, China, was all routed through Switzerland by Wild Bill Donovan in the OSS and Alan Dulles. Now, I will point out there is information coming out. It's not new information, but talking about this may have been the primary motivation for Dulles getting JFK out of the way, because JFK had been telling people he wanted to split up the CIA, which was Dulles's organization. And if Dulles was in charge of figuring out ways to launder this gold from Japan and Germany, then obviously Dulles was the man to make sure Kennedy was not in the way.
And this could explain why the JFK files were not released, because Trump said, you know, he was going to release them and then they didn't, because maybe what he's seeing is what we've already seen, is that the Brits are behind all of this treachery against the United States. They are not our friends. And why I bring up the Chase issue is because in the United States, we're facing a huge economic reset. We all know it. We know it's not the coronavirus. It's the economy. We're falling off a cliff. And J.P. Morgan is hoarding the silver of the American people. And we need it, and we want it, and we need to go take it, because they committed treachery against us.
I've just heard from business people here locally that they're actually holding deposits of payments in their business.
They are. Credit card payments. In my small business, Chase is sitting on deposits that my customers have made through their credit cards, and they have not pushed it through to us. And then on the PPP, they failed to serve the small and medium-sized companies on the ground. They kept saying their site wasn't quite ready to take the applications. When the local and regional community banks could process it, Chase couldn't. Then a few weeks later, oh, okay, now we can process it, after Trump had called them out with a tweet. So Chase is not our friend. They are an enemy of the United States.
Well, we can see why now, because they have been at this game a long time, and their presence is huge in this Marshall Plan. J.P. Morgan and Rockefeller pretty much drove the bus here, and as we now know, we have to say that was the Rothschilds, because the Rothschilds coached J.P. Morgan and Andrew Carnegie and how to do this banking right. So the people from the Carnegie Institute are all over this committee, along with Rockefeller Institute, the other interesting one is many labor unions were involved, and it looks like the labor union leaders were all getting their piece of the pie here. So it's a very convoluted mix. But when you see the list of people here and you compare that to the attacks on President Trump and our economy right now, there are some companies that have fallen off, but it is a very close correlation that these people who got set up with the Marshall Plan did not share. They kept it among themselves, and they have been profiting from all of their ill-gotten gain ever since 46, for sure. And many of them before that, including NBC, CBS, though they're participating here too.
In a second, I'll bash J.P. Morgan Chase, but I first want to bash the Dulles brothers, because when you say the Dulles brothers, you're talking about CIA, and when you say CIA, you're saying British-created OSS-CIA.
Right.
CIA has always been a bunch of traitors working for the Anglo-American hegemony, which is basically the Agreement of Five Eyes, which you have pointed out. It was so corrupt from the beginning and is still corrupt to this very day. So, Alan Dulles was fired as the head of the CIA, and he refused to leave. He was fired by Kennedy, and a few months later, he killed Kennedy, and that's a fact. The other Dulles brother is the major lawyer for all the big bankers on the East Coast. And he was part of the inquiry. He's part of the CIA, Council on Foreign Relations. He's part of everything. He is the Rothschild. Remember, when you say Morgan, you're saying Rothschild. So
they're
it's the
both
Rothschild.
Pilgrims.
Yep. and they're all pilgrims.
I think, Douglas, one of the things I think we need to stop doing is we need to stop saying CFR, because the CFR is an offspring of the Pilgrim Society. And I think that's been a useful confusion factor in people talking about how these people conspire with each other. And the CFR is not the center of this. It's the Pilgrim Society.
That's true. Because Cecil Rhodes and his white imperialism and empire building went into his round table, then into the Milner Kindergarten, then the Milner round table, and then the Royal Institute for International Affairs, and then Chatham House. And then it came over and it became the Council on Foreign Relations. So all that is a meeting. But the members, some are pilgrims, and those are the principal corrupt evil people. There can be members of the Council on Foreign Relations that are simply being used. They might be generals. They might be all kinds of media people, just like the Empire Press
Union. Do you believe that? I don't believe any of those people were used. I think they all knew what they were into, and that's why they were there.
Well, I'm being nice. Yes, I think anyone who goes to a CFR meeting that doesn't know that it is a British control mechanism for our foreign relations, which controls all wars, and it is the warmongering institute of the federal government. And as Hillary said, she goes to the CFR to get her marching orders.
Well, let me point out that the CFR was organized in 1919 after World War One. The first president was Elihu Root, and Root had been the Secretary of State and I believe the Secretary of War. He was personal attorney for Andrew Carnegie. He was the first president of the Carnegie Institute, Carnegie Endowment for World Peace, International Peace. And he was the founder of the Council on Foreign Relations. And he was a founding pilgrim in 1902. So we're talking about a group of people that gave themselves many names, but it all roads lead back to the Pilgrim Society.